sure I'm thinking clearly, it better be clear. If I don't use any cliches, I'd like you to think about it. Just pay attention to me. If you hear any sound bites, tell me afterwards. Cross them out. It's supposed ostensibly against that. So it's so good to be here, standing in this room. As Marty said, I was a student here 10 years ago. Walked into this room not a Christian, and left this house about 3 months later a Christian, much to my surprise. Sitting back at that desk over there, looking out at the snow, a winter term. So it's very strange and wonderful to be standing here 10 years later, talking to all of you. Some of you I know, some of you I don't. I hope that we'll get to know each other a little bit tonight. I'll speak for hopefully not too long, depending on how many tangents I head down. And then afterwards, you guys will get a chance to speak back. In the Labrie tradition, we don't just try to put information out at you and hope that you'll just take it and go away, change, but that you'll respond, and we'll work with the ideas together, that we can learn something from one another by pushing on things, pulling on things, seeing what they are a little bit better. So don't feel like, don't be shy, I guess, is the thing. Don't be shy with the material I put out there tonight. So this evening I'd like to speak to you about thinking clearly. This lecture grew out of a lunch discussion, which is an important part of the Labrie life, is just sitting down for a good hour and a half and kicking around a question at lunch. It's usually done 4 or 5 times a week at Labrie. And after one lunch discussion, a Lithuanian girl actually came up to me and said, "I want to learn how to think better. I don't know how to do that. Can you help me? I want to think better." And I thought it was a wonderful question because she was a very interested person in thinking, but she would get muddled when she'd start talking, but she wanted to wrestle with things. You could tell she was struggling with it. And she came to this really good question: how do I think better? And I said, that is a good question. Let's work on this together. So this lecture has grown out of that conversation. Labrie, I think, has a tradition of clear thinking. It's one of the hallmarks of Labrie Fellowship. And I think it comes from two things, really. The first is a deep commitment to the fact that Christianity is true, with a capital T. Christianity is the truth. And that is a deep foundational commitment that we have at Labrie. But we also have a deep, deep commitment to each person that comes to Labrie with questions about that truth and struggles with it. So you have this deep commitment to the truth of Christianity and people that are struggling with it in the same house. And trying to deal with both and take both seriously and be committed to both has forced us to really think hard, to think well, to think clearly. And I think it's a training ground in some senses. And I think Labrie students, as they spend time at Labrie, pick this up. And it's one of the greatest joys of going through a term of 2 months or 3 months with students is to watch them get better at thinking together. It's sort of an ongoing conversation that goes on table after table, tea time after tea time, lecture after lecture, and it's a joy to watch people get better at thinking. So tonight what I'd like to try to do is to put together in an hour or so just some things I've learned from my time thinking alongside many, many people at Labrie. We'll break this lecture into 4 headings. We'll start with obstacles and difficulties in thinking clearly in the age of sound bites and viral videos. Secondly, I want to make the case for just why is it important that we do it? Why is it important? Why should Christians, why should humans learn to think well and think clearly? Thirdly, what is required of us and in us? What needs to happen in us? Who do we need to be to think well, to think clearly? And then fourth, just sort of, how do we do it? Can we get some sort of details, some practical, how do we think well? How do we think clearly? So, everybody on board? This needs to be a bit of call and response, because the quieter you are, the boreder I get, and the less I enjoy lecturing. So this is all about me. So feel free to respond in some way, nodding of heads, snoring, whatever. That kind of thing. Preach it. So, let's kick off. Number one, obstacles towards thinking clearly. I would argue that we live in a world that is moving away from clear thinking very quickly. We live in a world that does not encourage us to think well, to think deeply, to think clearly. And in some ways, many have despaired of the possibilities of doing so. So I think this is a very important topic. It's not, we don't live in a culture that encourages us to think well and to think clearly. We live in a culture that actually stands against that in many ways. And I'd like to highlight a few of those ways just to set the stage. It's easy to critique. It's easy to say what's bad and what's wrong. And it's much harder to make a positive case. So we'll just try to keep it brief on the critique side. But number one, we live in a very complex world. We live in a world that is getting more complex. We are living in a world in which we are more aware of the complexity of this world. And I think because of this, a lot of people just think, this is just too much for me. I cannot understand this world. It is so complex. In the age of globalization, where cultures are colliding, where ideas fly back and forth, people fly back and forth, we can connect with so many different worldviews, religions, types of people, types of ways of thinking, all of them at our fingertips in our computers, and we're just overwhelmed. It's like walking into a Walmart that's 20 miles long, which is like the experience of my wife moving to America, walking into any grocery store here. Just an ocean of ideas, an ocean of options, an ocean of things to think, and different people who think them. And people look at this and are just overwhelmed. In the realm of science and technology, in the last 200 years, scientific knowledge has exploded in every field. Every realm has gotten bigger and branched out and farther and deeper, so that by the time you end up with a PhD, you've had to burrow down some hole so far that you have no idea about anything else but this tiny little sliver of your field. And I think I've talked to many science PhDs that say, I have no clue what's going on, even in the rest of my field, because I have to spend so much time and attention on this tiny little bit of it just to push knowledge a little bit farther. And these are the experts. These are the ones with PhDs are saying this. So what about the rest of us? We're looking at all the science that's going on. How can I wrap my mind around all this? How can I know any of this? But then the internet puts it all in my pocket or on my desktop, and it's all accessible to me, and I can be aware of its existence, even more overwhelming. And I think a lot of people in the face of this just back off. Just leave it to the experts. Just leave it to the experts. Number two, we live in the age of distraction. We live in the age of distraction. And I would put that blame firmly on the digital revolution. The internet is distraction par excellence. On every web page that you'll ever visit, you will be given so many options to do something, to make a choice, to click here, to click there, to go here, to go there. Every time you look at something on the internet, you are presented with an array of choice. Again, your 20-mile-long Walmart. Where do I go? And every one of them is promising you something interesting, something stimulating, something that will satisfy some craving or give you some sort of stimulation of something. Every single second, you are overwhelmed with choice. I would like to recommend very much to you a book called The Shallows by a fellow named Nicholas Carr. It was written about 5 years ago, which in digital terms is like, you know, this is old literature now, which is true. I find most any book on technology is just obsolete within a year. But this guy, it's lasting. And you go and read it, and it's even more pertinent today. And it doesn't get less pertinent, the things he's getting after. So what he did, he's a writer mostly on the digital world, digital technology, business, that kind of thing. He wrote for Wired magazine, and what he noticed one day, I think he was on holiday, he picked up a book and he started reading it, and he realized he couldn't get through a full page of text of serious writing. And he'd been like a literature major in college, I think, and he just noticed in himself he couldn't read a page of writing anymore. And he was like, what is going on? This is not cool. I used to be a literature major. I used to be able to read huge tomes, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and I can't get through this page right now. And so it just posed this question for him. What's going on in my head? What's going on in my brain right now? And he went and he did a bunch of research just studying into the cognitive psychology research on internet use. This is where he thought he might be heading, you know, this might be the cause of his problem. And he put together this wonderful book that I think is very thoughtful and philosophically nuanced for a sort of pop science book. And what he found is that the way that the internet is structured actually is fundamentally rewiring the way our brains work. The way we think, the way your brain works, is conditioned by the way you use it. And if you always use the internet as your way of thinking, if you spend a lot of time doing that, it's going to change the way that you think and the way you are able to think.
Excuse me, what was the guy's name?
His name is Nicholas Carr, C-A-R-R. So they've done lots of studies on this. Just to focus on one of them, the internet all over does this, but even if you think of educational type web pages like Wikipedia or some sort of publications that are related to more deep content, that would be more, we would think of as being more substantive, they found just the way that the websites are structured inhibits you from learning. Just the existence of a link within text actually inhibits you from retaining anything from what you've read. Not anything, but a lot less. They've done extensive studies on this, that if you take a page of text and you put hyperlinks within this page of text that link you to other options, like if a reference to another writer or scientist or topic is put in there, they have two groups of people read these texts. And one group, they thought, back when they were making hyperlinks, they thought this was going to be a revolution in learning. They thought we were going to be able to expand our knowledge hugely by this ability to bounce here, bounce there, pick up on that topic, go see what's interesting. What they find is the ones that read those pages and who are allowed to do that retain significantly less of the material than the ones that just have the straight text. Study after study has shown this. And it makes sense, actually, when you think about it, because when you're reading, you're doing one activity. You're reading, right? What happens when you come to a hyperlink? What do you have to do at that point? You have to choose. Exactly. You have to make a choice. So you've just switched from taking in something to having to make a choice. Totally different activity. And what happens is like somebody doing that, and your attention is drawn away, and you have to make a decision. Even if you read that hyperlink page and don't click on a single link, you've still had to make the choice each time you saw a hyperlink not to go on to the next one. And your engagement with the actual topic, the material, is hugely reduced.
That's so counterintuitive to what the whole internet is, because if you have a page full of just text without those hyperlinks, it's not as attractive.
Yep, not as attractive. Our brains have been trained to look for this. Well, it's sort of enticing. It wants to give you something. It's offering you another, more knowledge. Wikipedia, you could just tunnel on forever. But every time you jump to the next page, you've just wiped what you were reading on the last one, or a good part of it. So that's distraction with that. And I think it's worth mentioning briefly, I've cut this section like 5 times and cut more and more out of it because it's just a rant, really. But it's the whole viral videos phenomena. And I think it's really, I just want to say that the viral video is quintessential web distraction, and it is one of the most destructive cultural forces you could imagine. And I don't need to say too much more, except for Gangnam Style. Have you ever heard of Gangnam Style? It's called Gangnam Style. I feel really silly trying to describe it. So it's a music video by a Korean pop artist called Psy. I don't even know how to verbally say it. And it's a video of this guy doing a music video with a very silly dance and lots of sort of sarcastic references to pop culture. That's it. It's been viewed 2.5 billion times. It has been viewed 2.5 billion times. It's one of the most viewed videos on YouTube. At 4.2 minutes long, 4 minutes and 12 seconds long, that equates to 20,000 years. Okay, 20,000 human years of human life have been spent watching this video. Now, that's just the top one. That does not count the hundreds of thousands of other ones that have all been watched millions of times as well. And what I just see is just human life pouring down the drain. Human life pouring down the drain. T.S. Eliot said back in the 40s, I believe. I'm supposed to be clicking along here. Sorry. Nah, look at that. The viral video immediately attracts our attention by offering us a glimpse of things we'd never experience otherwise, thereby allowing us to momentarily escape our normal life. T.S. Eliot said beautifully in his 4 quartets that we are distracted from distraction by distraction, filled with fancies and empty of meaning. Just think of, you click on one thing for distraction and then it leads you to clicking onto another thing to distract you from that last distraction. But they're filled with fancies and empty of meaning. Blaise Pascal said, "The only thing which consoles us for our miseries is diversion. And yet this is the greatest of our miseries, for it is this which principally hinders us from reflecting upon ourselves, and which makes us insensibly ruin ourselves. Without this, we should be in a state of weariness, and this weariness would spur us to seek a more solid way out. But diversion amuses us and leads us unconsciously towards death." Now, it's interesting the point he makes. He doesn't say that if you avoid distraction or discipline yourself somehow, all of a sudden you're going to feel really great. And your life is going to be awesome if you avoid all the distraction. No, he's going to say, you'll actually then be confronted with yourself. And you'll have to deal with it. And you might have to find a more solid way out. Which I think is a wonderful point that he makes. Point number three, moving on in our critique. One of the things standing in the way of clear thinking, I would say, is a shrinking in the use of language. The English language is dying, people. It won't die altogether, but it's shrinking. The English language is shrinking. Now, you can measure this in lots of different ways. You could do science on it in lots of different ways, and there's a lot of debate about how one might do that. But one interesting one recently I found was one of these metadata studies where they crunch huge amounts of data and find out interesting things. And one group did a metadata study of word death and birth by just everything that's in Google Books. So Google Books has basically every printed word scanned and archived. And they just look at the word usage, the amount of times a word is used every year. And they chart the sort of rise and fall of different words. Now, in every language, this is always happening. Words are coming into vogue. Words are going out of vogue. That's very common. But what they found is in the last 50 years, there's this huge spike in word death. A huge spike in word death. And there are lots of new words being created, but they found that those words are usually actually scientific, technical descriptors. So like new compounds that are created, new species that are found. That's the largest category of words that are coming to life. And the words that are dying are ones that have to do with more metaphysical, poetic ways, things that describe human interaction, human experience on that level. These are the words that are disappearing. Now, I think this is a very, very interesting and unhappy reality. You can blame lots of things. I don't know what it all is. But I do know from my own experience that as I've shifted from social media to social media, what there has been a tend is towards shorter sentences, smaller amounts of communication. So when emails started moving to phones, all of a sudden I discovered I didn't want to write long emails. And when I noticed that people that used to write very wordy, thoughtful tomes, sometimes my dad, when he got an iPhone, I started getting 2-sentence letters from him. And the amount of content, the amount of language usage in writing, shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. Down to the tweet, which is reducing the amount of information that we can put smaller and smaller amounts. I don't know why this is happening or what I don't quite understand it. Some of you might help us later. But what we're moving towards is pithy phrases and sound bites and cliches here. I think if you've been paying attention to the Republican nomination, the power of the pithy phrase and the power of the soundbite is really ruling in this election cycle. Policies, nobody wants to hear about policies. People want the quick word, the quick bam, the quick in your face, boring, low energy, make America great again. This is a platform for running for the president of the United States now. And you hear pundits being like, tearing their hair out, and people that are into policy and stuff like that. Like, that's not a policy. You can't run a country like that. But I think some are really keying into what people want and what they like and what they're attracted to is the short, pithy phrase that just hits it in the gut. I'd like to talk about this much more later about why I think this is damaging. Ooh, it's going to be long tonight. Sorry. Number four, distrust of the intellectual, distrust of ideas. You could ask a better philosopher than I am. I'm not a philosopher at all. To talk about the history of ideas and how the postmodern world, the postmodern movement and philosophy has moved away from a trust in ideas and away from a confidence in the theoretical. But at the ground level, I can tell you that most people have lost confidence in the theoretical. Most people have lost confidence in the idea that we can use words to describe reality in some deep and meaningful way. People just don't believe that we can do this anymore. Except for the physical sciences. They get a pass somehow. They're allowed. But what this leads to in a lot of people's experience is a preference for the emotional and a preference for the experienced. Because if I can't know anything, that's what they tell me, I know what I feel, and I know what I've experienced. That's real to me. And ideas, well, I don't really know. They might be real, they might not. Philosophical concepts, maybe, I don't know. But I know what I feel, and I know what I experience. I've heard a few times during a lunch discussion at Labrie, it's usually about in the second or third week after people start sharing something that's maybe more intimate or personal or make themselves vulnerable in the community. I've heard it said quite a few times, that was the first real lunch discussion we had. Like, really? I thought we'd been having some really good discussions about all sorts of different things. But for people, when we get to the personal and intimate, that's reality. That's reality. And I really feel for them in that. It's good to have personal discussions. These are important things. But this is not all of reality. All this intellectualizing, people say, is just trying to avoid the personal. A lot of people say that. But I actually have found that all this emotionalizing is actually used as a defense against the theoretical, a defense against the question why, the defense against the question of how can that be or what is reality if I just stick with what I feel. So that's number four, a sort of distrust of the intellectual. Okay, we made it through the critique. It's going to be a long one. I'm sorry. We'll take a little intermission after a little while, okay? So, section number two, why think clearly? Why think clearly? I want to give you three reasons. The first one, if you're a Christian, the Bible commands it. You are commanded in Proverbs. We should be on slide six. Yep, there we go. You are commanded. Blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations. By understanding he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge the deeps were divided and the clouds let drop the dew. Now I want to draw your attention to two things. First of all, it's just the basic command. Seek wisdom, get it. This is something you should strive for if you are a Christian. And I would suggest that this is for everyone's benefit as well. But secondly, what I want to show you is that it's a little more subtle in regards to the nature of wisdom itself. In this passage, what we see wisdom described as is having to do with dividing of the deeps and the dew. When we're talking about geology here, we're talking about physics. Wisdom has to do with all of reality. Okay, in Christian circles, I think there can be a pietistic trend towards wisdom, meaning just knowing what the right thing to do is. Pietism being sort of an emphasis on the moral life. So to be a wise person is to be the kind of person that always knows what to do, what the moral thing to do would be. Well, Proverbs says that wisdom, it has to do with understanding the earth's foundations. God's understanding set the heavens in place. His knowledge is about the deeps that are divided and the clouds that let drop the dew. So that's just a very basic point, that wisdom is seeing all of reality clearly, knowing it well. The writer continues, he doesn't continue. In the previous chapter, he says, wisdom cries aloud in the streets. She raises her voice in the public squares. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. In the gateways of the city, she makes her speech. How long will you simple ones love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery? And fools hate knowledge. I thought that this is really a push at our viral videos. This is a push at laughing at politicians who fall in disgrace and we watch videos of them being awkward or telling their sob stories on TV. This is a push against the simple ones loving simple ways and simple words. Simple explanations, quick answers, easy answers. How long will you love the simple way? This is a condemnation of our stock answers and cliche understandings of the world. Wisdom says, if you had responded to my rebuke, if you had responded to my rebuke, I would have poured out my heart to you, and I would have made my thoughts known to you. And this brings us to our second reason why we should seek to think clearly. Is because if we seek to think clearly and seek it from the one from whom all wisdom pours, he will pour out his heart to us. God has poured out his thoughts to us, namely in creation. The 16th century astronomer Johannes Kepler said, I was just thinking God's thoughts after him. Now, that's a wonderful thing. He said, I was thinking God's thoughts after him. So what that means is when we look at something in reality that God has created, and when we understand it rightly, we're actually sharing something of God's experience. So God has a thought in his mind, whatever that means analogously, it's a difficult thing. But before he creates something, he has the thought in his mind. He creates it, he puts it into reality. He puts it into reality, we perceive it, we interact with it, we experience it. If we understand it truly, then our mind is then filled with it, and we are sharing in his experience. It's a wonderful communication from God through his creation and to us. Now, Francis Schaeffer illustrated this beautifully in True Spirituality with a discussion of this painting. I'll read you this quote. Can you guys see? Yeah. So he says, the arm of God is thrown backwards, and there are two kinds of figures under his arm. There are some little cherub figures that one would take to be the Renaissance idea of the representation of angels. But there is another person under his arm, a beautiful girl. Can you see her? A beautiful girl under his arm. Now, many people have felt that this is a representation of Eve. Some have also said Mary, but it actually works similarly. Schaeffer says, she's not yet created. So right now in this scene, God is creating or giving life to Adam over here. She's not yet created, but she is in the mind of God. Eve became externally, objectively real at that great moment when God put Adam to sleep and made the male from the female. But if Michelangelo meant that before God created Eve, he had already thought of her, then this is flamingly true. So it's a wonderful thing. When you look at any other person, you are seeing something that began as an idea in God's mind. This is mind-boggling. This is mind-boggling. There's no just sort of ordinary things around you. Every person you look at, every time you look at a person, you are seeing an expression, the full realization of something that began as an idea in the mind of God. This is a magnificent truth. And I find it to be actually, when I ponder it rightly, and actually by that I mean allow myself to be open to the truth of this fact, it's a really intimate and wonderful thing. It's an intimate and wonderful thing. That when I truly understand something, I'm actually sharing in the mind of my Creator. We are to think his thoughts after us. After him, sorry. And thirdly, very briefly, we should be thinking clearly because it impacts all of our life. Thinking clearly is not just about being good at math or being good at philosophy. Being able to think clearly will impact every single part of your life. If you cannot think clearly about emotions and your own emotional life, then your emotions will just be a swirling mass of insanity spilling out onto the table all over the place and you won't know what's going on. If you cannot think clearly about the physical realm, you will run into the wall. But you will also miss out on the beauty of building bridges and of dancing and of making beautiful things out of clay or out of zucchinis or out of anything. Interacting with all of reality requires that you be able to think clearly about it, to see the thing that you're working with, to interact with it well, to interact intelligently in reality. This is not just about being able to do good philosophy. So that's why we really need to think clearly. I told you it was very brief. Okay. How are we doing? Good. Section 3. What is required to think clearly? I want to suggest to you tonight that if you want to learn how to think clearly, you have to become a better person. If you want to think clearly tonight, you have to become a better person. A lot of people, when they want to learn how to do something, they want to learn the best technique for it. They want some sort of structured technique that if I do this, 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 and this, then it'll get me to where I want to go. That's what our culture likes these days, is techniques. But I'm not going to give you techniques tonight. And I want to commend to you virtues, actually. I want to commend two virtues to you that if you develop these, if you learn to develop these in your person, they will aid you in thinking clearly. It's very simple. Curiosity and patience. Curiosity and patience. Now, Ben Kais, one of the workers here, has done a lot of work on curiosity. I would just point you to his lectures. I won't add too much to it. But I do want to take it in a direction here. So very basically, curiosity is just the desire to know more. Curiosity is the desire to move closer to something, to see it, to know it, to become more intimate with that thing. That's what curiosity is to come into contact with something that is unfamiliar, that you don't know, and to choose to move towards it, to grow in your understanding of it. Now, what stands directly in opposition to curiosity, I would say, is actually the cliché, the soundbite. The cliché and the soundbite, as I referenced earlier, stands in direct opposition to curiosity. The reason I signaled them out earlier is because they are poisonous to curiosity. They are tools we use to defend ourselves against reality, actually. Clichés and soundbites defend us against reality. There's a very interesting woman named Hannah Arendt who wrote a book about the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who was one of the perpetrators of the Final Solution in Nazi Germany. Now, he was an administrator. He wasn't like a gulag. You know, he wasn't like a prison camp captain killing people. He worked in an office building, Adolf Eichmann. The Jews found him in Argentina back in the 70s, I think, and put him on trial. Hannah Arendt was a philosopher, and she went to this trial and she reported back on it. And what she found very strange was this man, Adolf Eichmann, in his trial, only spoke in cliches and stock phrases, she said. So when he was asked about what he thought about what he was doing, he would only respond with things like, "I didn't kill anybody. I'm not a bad man. I didn't kill anybody. I'm not a bad man." And what she found that he was utterly, utterly defended against the reality of what he'd done. And the way that he defended himself was by using pithy short phrases that seemed to sum it up and close the door to any discussion about what had happened or what he had done to protect him from the reality of what he'd been involved in. She says, I wrote it down here for you guys. Clichés and stock phrases are adherence to conventional standardized codes of expression and conduct have the socially recognized function of protecting us against reality, that is, against the claim on our thinking attention that all events and facts make. So the clichés that he used pretended to answer the question, and for him, he said, he would hold in his mind, these have answered the question, the question's answered. I'm not a bad man. I didn't do anything wrong. I was just doing my job. I was just doing my job. I didn't kill anybody. I'm not a bad man. Over and over. Now, see, the way this works, I think, is that when you run into a question, when you run into something new that you don't understand, question arises in your mind. Questions can be uncomfortable. And when you get a new question in your head, you either have to somehow force yourself to forget the question or you have to have an answer, or it will remain a tension inside of you. And it's going to sit there, and it's going to be uncomfortable. Now, what I think a lot of people do is they find a good stock answer, and they put it in that answer place. They're like, that sounds good enough, we'll put it in there. And what it does is it means that I can say that I've answered that question, and I don't have to worry about it anymore. But what we wouldn't say is that they have actually grown in understanding and depth of clarity and understanding of this question that they had. And I think that's very often how these clichés get used. They kill curiosity. Number two is patience. Okay? Back to a blank slide. Number two is patience. And this is the obvious one. So we're about halfway through the lecture. Feeling tired. It's Friday. It's late. I'm not saying that my lecture is something that you necessarily will learn anything from, but if you're going to, it's going to take patience because it's going to take time because it's uncomfortable. You have to grow in patience. And it's very difficult to do in the age of the internet, where everything is suggested to be right at the tips of your fingers. Any question I have, just Google it. Any question I have, just Google it. Let's just look it up. Let's just look it up. Let's just look it up. And we have this illusion that anything I want to know is just so close and I can have it. What that does is that when you hit something that actually requires more time than one sentence to answer, we don't have the capacity to find the answer anymore. We don't have the capacity to sit in the discomfort and the quiet and the tiredness and the not knowing for long enough to find this answer out. It's uncomfortable. It's sort of awkward. Very often at Libri lunch discussions, we started out by saying, "What would you like to talk about today?" And there's always this awkward silence. And then someone asks the question, and then there's usually another awkward silence right after the question is asked. And what I sense in this awkward silence is, I don't know. Where do we go with this? Where do we go with this? And there's this sort of desire to avoid, I've sensed, quite often. But if we sit through it, sit through that discomfort that we don't know, then we actually can get somewhere. But questions don't get answered easily. And often when you have a question, you'll end up with other questions. And when you find the answers to those questions, you might realize that you don't like the answer to those questions, so you go looking for more. And it becomes a long process. And maybe the answers that you find actually challenge you to examine yourself and make you look at uncomfortable things about yourself. And that can get uncomfortable. That can cause discomfort. And we don't like this.
Are you interested in comments now, or will you send me something?
Sure.
I just wasn't sure if you wanted to.
Yeah, go for it.
Snoring was okay, nodding, questions, it's probably even better.
I think, in general, I agree with what you're saying. Uh-huh. But I also think that the amount of knowledge that's available to people to know now is overwhelming.
Mm.
And that part of that plugging in an answer is a defense mechanism that is also that allows you to manage what you want to know.
Mm.
Because there's simply... They talk about the fact that, you know, one of the measures of intelligence is your ability to multitask and to handle different things at the same time. But there's so much information out there that some of those questions that you are Googling to get the answer to, you wouldn't have even known to ask 10 years ago, 20 years ago, because there wasn't that much information out there.
Mm.
So is it a bad thing to Google to get a piece of information about something that 10 years ago you wouldn't even have been curious enough to pursue at all versus not pursuing it? In other words, you've only got so much capacity to understand. So I think that there has to be, to some degree, a defense for managing information and what you choose to think about with some of those techniques, if you can call that.
Mm.
I'm just curious what you thought.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Sorry? What do you do with Walmart?
Because of the information in Walmart, you can't visit every aisle. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a question that I've toyed with in the curiosity section, because the internet can encourage a kind of curiosity that's not a virtue, that is just sort of filling of little voids, like random question, fill it with an answer. And I don't think that's quite the same thing as the virtue of curiosity. And I haven't worked out quite the distinction between the two, but my gut says that it's actually, I would want to push against that tendency that you're talking about. That we've got a quick question, let's just look it up real quick. And I think it actually sits with the patience issue well. Like at a lunch discussion at La Brie, we've frowned upon pulling out phones to check for anything. And just sit with the fact that you don't know it right now. Just sit with that. And be patient and be attentive to where you actually are and the resources that you actually have present and what's actually going on with you. And so I would actually encourage that discipline, that just because you have a random question doesn't mean that it needs to be answered right now. It's not necessarily the thing. So I think what's needed more is a discipline of saying no to some questions for the sake of the greater, the more important question that's at hand. Maybe there'd be a distinction between sort of random offshoots and like what is the driving path that we're going down. So at our lunch table, we had a whole set of encyclopedias sitting on the back of the pew that sat as one of our bench where students would eat. And one time in the years that we had it, I was like, let's pull it out because we actually need this answer to keep moving, because there was sort of, it was just like we kept getting stuck on this one little bit. We just need to understand this bit to help us move through, and then we chose to do so. So it is, I saw a hand. Do you want to go after that a bit, Ken?
Well, I was thinking a great example of what you're talking about is GPS.
Uh-huh.
When we lived here 20 years ago, we knew the area cold.
Hmm.
You know, because I had to find my way around.
Hmm.
Now I just go, I still can't find my way around my own neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to.
Yeah.
I just look it up.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess it's a question of what are you doing with, why do you need to look it up? Why do you need this information? What are you doing with it once you get it, I guess? Yeah, Becky.
If you're just dropping it right away, it's probably not.
Sorry?
Because if you're just dropping it right away, it's probably just, it's not curiosity, it's just probably distraction.
Mm. Yeah, this is something that I was getting at, is that what is the difference between a viral video? A viral video is feed on curiosity. I want to know what it looks like to see the trunk of a car explode while I was driving down the highway. And this link is offering me a view of that. Now, in a sense, that's curiosity. It sounds like sort of interesting thing to see. But in another sense, there's a pervertedness of it, that it's sort of, it's filling us with an experience rather than wisdom and understanding about reality. So I've watched the car explode, and at the end of it, I haven't grown in anything except for wasted 30 seconds of my life. Yeah, in the back. Sorry, Becky.
I do research in the physical sciences.
Yeah.
And so I do research in the physical sciences, uh-huh, and I make contributions. I don't even attempt to keep up, quote unquote, keep up with the field.
Yeah.
But what you find is there are certain seminal papers that bring it together.
Uh-huh.
And you work your way around. You don't scatter yourself looking everywhere. You recognize quality when you see it.
Yeah.
You wait, and you know something's not quite right.
Hmm.
And so the information is out there, and you just don't take the first leap that you click on.
Hmm.
And I mean, one of Google's great features when I started was they accumulated the sites that people went to most.
Yeah.
And so those are high ranking, but pages that have had a lot of links to other pages that people went to were recognized as index pages.
Hmm.
That were condemned. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
So, I don't know if you can see the analogy I'm trying to make. That you can have curiosity, you can be confronted with all this stuff, but you know that out there, somewhere, if you're patient enough, you don't just spend, you work, do your own work, doodle around, and eventually you find these summary pages that give you a lot of information, or you write one yourself.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, sorry, there needs to be a process of discernment of value of information, you know, discern between the some pieces of information are more important than others, or more pertinent to where you're at and what you're doing right now. Okay, yeah, one more.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I think having information so readily available actually devalues it.
Yeah.
When you had to go into a library and construct a search and walk back in the stacks to find the information,
yeah,
you were really on a search.
Yeah. Yeah, so we need to recover some ability to value information again in an age where it's so ubiquitous. That was when LaBrie was discussing whether or not to put their lectures online. There was this question of, like, will it not just devalue it? Because people are downloading thousands of things. They download so many podcasts, some of this. They listen to them, it's just sort of this wash of information. And in LaBrie's tradition, the lectures are a really valuable resource. When I first came here, I had 3 on tape. And I walked in, and there was a tape catalog. It's gone now. I don't know where it's gone. It's right over there. And I was like, wow, that's gold, right? They've got a whole wall of this stuff, you know? And I think when they were discussing putting it online, there was this question of, like, will we not be doing the same to it? And they decided to still do it, but that was definitely a question. Okay, sorry, once more.
Yeah, we talked about information in a subjective sense, but I think we can go past that. Before the internet, as far back as the first century, Paul talked about busybodies and gossips.
Yeah.
And these people lived, yeah, spreading information. And
yeah.
That.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that information wasn't worth spreading.
Yeah.
But there's other information that has objective value.
Mm.
It doesn't give it value. Mm. But those are the things we ought to seek.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is. Growing in maturity is required to be able to make that discernment. And I think in a sense, our culture used to filter these things a bit more. And like you're saying, there's the ubiquity of information, that filtering doesn't happen so much, or it's done for us by Google. Google tells us what's most important to know or important to think.
Just to extend that, because I'm going to close out with a question. I posted on the forum last week, I didn't get a great answer. But even in 2 Timothy, when he talks about acknowledging him to correctly handle the word of truth.
Mm.
The word of truth can be scripture, of course, but the word of truth might go beyond just the word of scripture, but all of it is known truth.
Mm.
And handling the word of truth, maybe that's some of the apologetics and theology of the field, command, just that.
Mm. Yeah, responsibility with information. Absolutely. Thank you all. Let's move on a little bit. That was a good intermission, but I'll let you have my intermission as well. It's this. So this it. Can you see it? well enough. This is a very, very interesting picture. I'm serious. Thank you. So I found this picture in a book that my son was bought at a charity auction at an antique railroad station. The pages were falling out. And this was the least interesting picture in the entire book to me. So it's a book that mostly just had pictures of railroads. They were all this grainy and washed out. And this is actually as clear as it was in the book. This isn't a bad rip. It's a very good copy. So when you look at the book, it's what you get. And I was reading it one day, as you do when your children are playing around your feet and you're watching them and not doing other things. And we were looking through it, and I was reading through this, and I got caught at this in this section here. So I'll read through. The engine blows off in the sidings to the left of the running lines. Where? Oh, there it is. Okay. Whilst hump shunting has been in progress on the right, the wagons in the sidings just above the locomotive chimney, having come off the hump, which is controlled by the signal by the Abbott Coke wagons. The numeral on the LMS brake van, the LNWR water column, the fire devil, and the fogman's hut repay study. Really? And I chuckled to myself. These guys are such geeks. I didn't even know which ones they were, and eventually started looking at it and said, this is LMS. So that must be the LMS brake van, the LNWR water column. I didn't even know what that was. The fire devil, I don't know, and the fogman's hut. I thought maybe that might be a hut. And it struck me this picture. These things repay study. This picture repays study. And I was struck at first by, because I had no idea how that could be the case to start with. But then I started looking into it, and I realized that the problem was with me. That the problem, in a sense, was with me, that there's no way I could have conceived that this could have repaid study, because I'm used to quick answers and flashy things and crisp, clear definition and hyperlinks to tell me what a brake van is and a water column and all of this. And I want this to stick with you, that for many people, actually, I don't know if are there any train aficionados in the world? Any train geeks here tonight? Any train geeks? Any train spotters? No? But for some people in this world, this is a fascinating picture. It is a fascinating picture. And they saw this picture and they were excited by it because of the interest that it held for them. And they put it in this book and wanted to share what they found with you. That this is a very interesting scene in the life of a British railroad back in the near the end of the age of steam, 1960s. And all of these things here have meaning. Every single object here is very meaningful objects. The hill that they're on is meaningful, as he says. They're hump shunting, which means they're pushing these cars over the hill. There is a water tower here that would fill the steam engines. There's a fire devil, which I looked up, is a tiny little coal stove right here with this pipe that goes that sits right under the water pipe to keep the pipe from freezing on cold nights so that the steam engines can get their water. And this is literally a hut for the fog man to stand in. On a foggy day, they had to do signaling closer together than normal, which would have normally been done by this, but on a really foggy day in England, you can't see it. And it's just full with exciting detail. And what this was a lesson to me is I need to grow in curiosity and patience and recognize that this person, whoever wrote this, had curiosity and patience about this particular thing. And it was a lesson to me. Not that we all need to be train geeks, but something like this can be interesting to somebody. Is actually a lesson, needs to be a lesson to us. Because things repay study. So if you don't remember anything else from this lecture, I want you to remember that reality repays study. Okay? And things will repay study that aren't necessarily interesting to you at the outset. Most of reality won't be interesting to you at the outset. Mostly we stick with what we know and just slightly branch out from there. But reality repays study, especially the number on the LMS brake van. Not just the LMS brake van, the number on the LMS brake van repays study. And all of reality is this interesting, actually. Now, you know, it leads us back to the question of, you know, should we dive down every rabbit hole? No, not necessarily. But this repays study. Okay, so I'll leave that picture up and you can meditate that on that. Tell me if it repays your study at all as you look at it. So I recommended to you virtue. You need to grow in virtue to think clearly. And lastly, I want to recommend to you two categories. So instead of techniques, I want to commend to you virtue and truth. Is really what it is. So to think clearly, you need to become a better person. You need to become a holier person. You need to become a more mature human being. And you need to have the right categories of reality. You need to have more truth. You need to have better truth. Two categories of reality. Not techniques, categories. So, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and he separated it from the darkness. "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." Here he's referring to the heavens above and the deeps of the ocean, the place where we live. "Let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. And let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." Now you can read on, keep reading through the first chapters of Genesis as God creates the world. But I want to point out to you what God is doing here. What God is doing when he creates is he gives things their form and then he relates them to one another. So he gives them distinctions and he gives us relationships. These are two categories that I want to give you that I think are at the heart of the Christian worldview. And to use these categories well, this is a squirrel up in the attic. Distracted from distraction by distraction. Two categories of reality that are found at the very heart of the Christian worldview, at the very heart of creation, distinction and relationship. We see it all over the Bible. In the Proverbs, I didn't give that to you on a slide. Proverbs, it says, "By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundations." Remember, "By understanding he set the heavens in place, distinguished the earth from the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps were divided, and the clouds let drop the dew." So what we have here is the distinction between the clouds and the earth, and then the relationship of the dew. Okay, so he distinguishes and relates. And I would say that this is at the heart of the Christian worldview. We shouldn't be surprised here, as God reveals himself to us to be both Trinity and Unity. God has distinction within himself. The Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Father. And the Father and the Son are not the Holy Spirit. But there is one God. One God. We have distinction and we have relationship. Even in the names Father and Son, we are given relationship. But they are distinct from one another. So we shouldn't be surprised to see this in his creation. Now, why is this so important? Why is this so important? Distinction and relationship. Well, let's just go through it a little bit. Think about how does distinction and how does relationship help us see clearly? If we desire to see clearly, we have to learn to distinguish between things well. When you first encounter something new, usually what you experience is sort of an undifferentiated swirling mass. Now, most of you don't have any memories of experiencing anything entirely new, but when you were born, and when you were in your mother's womb, it was probably the last time you ever experienced anything entirely, entirely new. But we still experience new things. You walk into a house, you meet a new person. Much of their form, much of this thing's form is not available to you, and it's indistinguishable to us. Some people get this experience, like blind people who receive their sight, or deaf people that receive their hearing later in life. They have this, then they describe this overwhelming experience of stimulation that comes into them, especially deaf people who have a cochlear implant put in, who've never heard before, and then they hear all of a sudden for the first time. What we would all think is like, this is great, but for them, usually their first experience is, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. This is horrible. This is painful. I cannot make any sense of this. I cannot make any sense of this. And I would expect that's what babies are going through most of the time. And I think that's why they cry a lot. This is overwhelming. And a lot of deaf people actually choose to return to being deaf. It is so overwhelming, the experience. But with us, it's the same thing, is that when we encounter something new, we have a hard time grappling with it. until we start to see, we start to explore it, if we're patient, if we're curious, we start to see its form, we start to see its distinction, we start to see where it begins and ends, we start to see where its parts are, the distinctions within, the shape of this thing, we start to experience this. It's like a blurry image that comes into focus and you gradually see it. So I'd like to show you a picture now. Do you recognize this picture? Anybody recognize this picture? Do you recognize this picture yet? Starting to recognize this? Do you recognize this picture? Do you recognize this picture? This is what life is like for us when we run and come into something new. It's an overwhelming, indistinguishable mass of sensation. When I first walked into these doors at Labrie, it was the same. When I first walked in, I was handed by a plate of spaghetti by Joe. I was met by Dick Kies, who was this like terrifying and huge man. And it was all overwhelming. And I couldn't distinguish one from the other. I didn't know what a helper was. I didn't know what a student was. I didn't know what a worker was. There's just all these people and all these things happening. But as I got to know it a bit, I got to see where those distinctions lie. This is where the Morels live. This is where Ben and Michaela live. Well, they weren't here at that time. This is the library. This is what it's for. These are all, you know, the distinctions, the shapes. It starts to become familiar to me. Yeah, a wonderful example of this in my life when I went on a backpacking trip with a friend of mine who was very into Scotch whiskey, not in the quantity but in the quality. And he brought with him on this backpacking trip four small bottles of different kinds of Scotch whiskey. Now, for me, hard liquor had always been just a horrible experience. I had no interest in it. It just tasted like poison in my mouth, and I wanted to have nothing to do with it. But he was into it, and I was curious, why would he possibly be into this thing? He wasn't into getting drunk. It was just a thing for him. So he brought it with him. And every night, sitting around the stove, the little Primus stove, I wouldn't say campfire, he would break out one of these bottles, and we would have a shot of a different kind of very high-quality whiskey. Now, before we would have this shot, he would say, now this one, he would tell me where it came from, how it was made, what kind of flavors I should expect to find. He'd say, so this one's a little bit smoky with a sweet finish. And then we'd drink it, and this one's a little bit lighter, and this one's has a honey taste at the beginning, but then finishes a bit harsher. And I would sip this whiskey, and what for me had always just been an experience of, this is not pleasant. Wait a minute, I see what you're talking about. That's there. Oh, wow, interesting. And what had gone from an overwhelming sensation that I couldn't distinguish within became something actually interesting and enjoyable. Now, how did he go about doing this for me? How did he help whiskey become something more than just ow in my mouth? What did he use? It's a real question.
Classification.
Language. Language. He used words. He told me what to expect, and then I could experience it. Because of language, we can make better distinctions. And this is why I want to commend this to you. And this goes back to our sound bites. This goes back to our cliches. We shouldn't be surprised that language is so important to understanding reality, to engaging with it rightly, as we are created by the one who describes his son as the Word. We should not be surprised by that. We are people of the Word. The Word is so essential to the Christian faith that it has personhood in Jesus, through whom all things were created. When God creates, he uses words. And when we use words, we it's sort of a sub-creative type of thing. That when we use words, we delineate things. We separate them things. We outline their boundaries. When we name something, we take it out of reality and say, look it, I want to show you this thing that's over here, and it's different from the others. And I use language to describe it to you, to show it to you, to share it with you. When we have a right word for a thing, when we can name it rightly, we become intimate with it, and we can communicate it to others. Now, this is why I would commend poetry to each of you. I would commend poetry to each of you. If you want to become better thinkers, clearer thinkers, read more poetry. Try to write it yourself. Try to describe things in better language. Because that's what poets are trying to do. They're trying to, as T.S. Eliot says, make a raid on the inarticulate. They're trying to grab onto something that's very hard to get, to see, to understand, and try to put a boundary around it and then to show it to you. That's what a poet's trying to do. They're trying to see a part of reality and then show it to you. Like my friend trying to show me the Scotch. That's what a poet is doing. And the cliche or the stock phrase is the arch nemesis of a good poem. I had a poetry teacher in university that he would hack through any cliche he found on a poem that we turned in. And he would say, that is how it generically feels. That's how it generically looks. What does it really look like? Tell me about it for real. Use real language to describe this thing. So we take the example of many a teenager said, let's say on a weekend, homework sucks. How was your weekend? Oh, I had to do homework. It sucked. Okay. Said something vaguely. But what if that teenager walked in and said, the homework assignment dragged at the back of my thoughts all Saturday long, sucking the delight out of any spontaneous moment. All right. I hear you. You've said something. You've said something very different from homework sucks. You've said something very different from homework sucks. He wrote a little poem. Jesus died for your sins. That's a cliche. In many Christian circles. It's been used so much that it's been sort of hollowed out of all of its meaning. But T.S. Eliot, in his poem, The Four Quartets, says, the wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Now this tells us something about the atonement. This tells us something about who Christ is. What he's done, how it affects us, how we are related with him. You see this bleeding hand hovering over you to heal you. That says something. That tells us something. Something specific. And if we destroy language, if we rely on cliches and stock phrases, we have a huge problem for thinking clearly. When you lose words, you lose the distinctions that those words used to make. C.S. Lewis says, when you've killed the word, you have also, as far as in you lay, blotted from the human mind the thing that word originally stood for. Men do not long continue to think what they have forgotten to say. I think it's very true. We must become poets. I haven't written enough poetry lately. Now we can go on for a long time. But I want to commend to you distinction. You have a question about something? What is that? Go and look and see how it is different from everything else. And then relationship, briefly. I don't want to speak so much on this necessarily. But the Bible presents the created reality to be a whole. God created the heavens and earth. He created it all. It's one thing. It's a whole. And God himself is a whole as well. But within it, we have all these distinctions. Now, how is it not just a chaos? How is it not just a chaos that we live in? Well, it's by relationship. Every object in reality stands in relation to every other object in reality. To be in God's creation is to be in relationship. So when God created in the first chapters of the Bible, we don't just say, he created this thing, he created this thing, he created this thing, he created this thing, he created this thing. No, what he did is he created them and then he related them together in many wonderful ways. So some of these ways include, I'll just read this nice list to you. Things separate, they fill, they team, they produce. They give, govern, increase. And that's just in the first 20 verses of the Bible. We get all of those wonderful relationships. All these things that God has created are related in these wonderful ways. The first 20 verses of the Bible. To be something at all means that you have to be in relationship. If you're not in relationship, you have no meaning. Take the example of music. One note, a certain frequency of vibrations in the air. Put them together in some meaningful form, you have music. But they have to be related meaningfully together. A note is a meaningless thing, but notes together become music. Now the same thing arises in the case of relationships as we talk to language. This is what poetry is all about. Poetry is all about relationships. When I was a kid, I thought to write a poem meant to say, this thing is like that. And this thing is like that. And this thing is like that. Now, I know there's a lot more to poetry, but just essential in poetry itself is the relating of things together. And the power of a poet is to show us how they relate. How are they similar? How are they linked together in a unity in reality? And again, if you lose language, you cannot do this anymore. You cannot see these relationships. You cannot share them with others. You are alien and alienated. Now, the two must be used together, distinction and relationship. And you need to pay attention to where your tendencies lie. What do you major on? What would you ignore? In our culture these days, we tend to major on the relationship. We like web thinking. We like interconnected things. We like brainstorming. We like bouncing around with our ideas. So maybe we should focus on distinction a little bit. Maybe we should focus and stop and say, what does this thing look like? What is it? What is it as itself? What are its boundaries? What is its form? I think that might be a reaction somewhat to an Enlightenment thinking that really like to take things and pull them out of reality and take them apart and cut them into little pieces to understand them. In the Enlightenment, I think they forgot to put them back into reality and to see how they're integrated into the rest of reality. So we've got Eve here. We can look very closely at her. It's been a magnificent thing to look at. We've got God's hand here. Her eyes, her expression. She's beautiful to look at. But then we remember she's here. All right. And what is God doing? He's creating Adam. And where is it? The whole of the biblical narrative streaming out in the Sistine Chapel. And you could back out to a nice picture of Rome and the whole world and all these different things. So that's the end of what I want to say mostly. I'm going to take you just to a little summary of what we've said. Now I want to urge you to stand against the forces that would lead you to distraction and distract you from your distraction and lead you to fancies and emptylessness and meaninglessness. Maybe examine yourself and see, what are you most susceptible to? Are you a sucker for a clickbait, as they call it? Do they call it? They call it clickbait. Ah, it's interesting. Do you get sucked into viral videos? Do you rely on cliches to describe your faith and think about your faith? Do they protect you from the deep questions? Or are you afraid of how complex the world has become? Is it just overwhelming to you? And then develop in yourself a love of wisdom that spans all of creation. Develop an attentiveness marked by curiosity and patience. And then go out and look at the myriad multiplicity of distinctions and relationships that you will find in this world. See them clearly. And love God with your whole mind by doing so. The end. So I'll leave that up as a reference for you guys. Yeah, we'll do this. What would you like to talk about? Now I sit down and drink a sip and you guys talk. Sorry, Nikayla's hand went up first.
Just a comment more than anything. It's really interesting reading children's literature because you see this sort of play out in the depth of language. I just read The Railway Children by Nesbitt to my children last week, and it was written like in 1906. And we're now reading Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. And the language...
Is that contemporary?
It's contemporary, mm-hmm. Yeah. It is... It's like a journal, basically. You're reading a journal of like, oh, man, this sucks. And as he's thinking, the story is really compelling and interesting, but there's something very elegant in, you know, The Railway Children, and it's a very simple story.
Hmm.
And just how... Even in the development of children's literature, how this is where it starts first is in what we read to our kids.
Hmm. I'm always struck. I'm struck with newspaper articles. Whenever you come across a quote from a newspaper article from anything over 50 years ago, it seems, you know, I'm just struck by the level of language that's a common level. Mm-hmm. You know, the newspaper was what everybody would have been reading, and. People's heads would spin if that was on CNN today. It really wouldn't. And it's just anecdotal, but just and it's not just in the. Yeah, I think a lot of people think that the way that people wrote in the olden days was sort of excessively flowery and excessively overdone, but this was just normal speech for people back then. Yeah. Yes.
Well, this may be old information to you, but it was new to me recently. In the medieval universities, some of them, they taught... Have you ever heard of what's called a trivium?
Mm-hmm.
A I'm not a regular, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk how to represent thought with symbols, which the grammar.
Yep.
How to think.
Yep.
And how to communicate thought.
Yeah.
I just thought that that was the foundation for. Anyway,
we didn't pay him to say that.
we have the founder of a classical school that's based on the Trivium here. Quite a few people involved in the school that are here tonight. No, thank you. That's great. You mentioned it. No, you're in good company here. That's all I'll say. Yeah. No, I think it's essential, and I know Linny and others could speak on it much more. But in our culture, we emphasize the expression form first, and we see that as being. So the center of self-actualization is to express what's going on inside yourself, and sort of human flourishing is found in self-expression. So that's where we start with kids. Just tell me how you feel. Tell us what was your experience of this, without telling them how to speak or think first. Like, oh, it sucked. What do you expect they're going to say? That's language for bad, or it was awesome. Is language for good, and that's about where it's going to end. Yeah, Marty.
There was a program on NPR last night. Talking about how to get kids to read books. And it's a guy, Damon? Somebody Damon. Mm-hmm. I've heard of his name before. Maybe someone else knows it.
In New York.
Yeah. He spent a year sitting in on three different classrooms, English teachers, in, I think, all state schools, and mixed, but quite a lot of underprivileged kids, and poor kids, you know, and this amazing quote. So one of the kids that he got closest to during this year was a boy who said, "Oh, books, they smell like old people." And the challenge was how to get kids to read books. But I didn't hear the whole program, but the thing that seemed to be most helpful was these teachers just read to them. They basically things that didn't happen to these kids as children, they just... A lot of them had single moms who were holding down three jobs and did not have time to read to their kids, even if they had the inclination to. And so, read. So these were junior high and senior high kids, I think, read To Kill a Mockingbird, and then asked them questions about, got them to see how these books related to their own lives. It was an interesting program, but just a kind of chilling thing.
Yeah,
books smell like old people.
Yeah. I was struck when I, this poetry class I mentioned, he forced us to read and comment on 10 poems a day at least. It was really, we had to pound through just tons of material. And I was struck by the fact of what it did to my brain, is that reading poetry every day, I started seeing the world in poetry. I started noticing reality better. It wasn't the fact that I was writing poetry. It was just the fact that I was reading it and had to read it in large volume every day. I think it's similar to what I was saying about how when God creates something and then we perceive it, we are sort of sharing in the internal experience of God. When someone writes something and you read it and understand it, you in a sense are sharing a mental experience. So just the fact that what you are reading is actually, you know, it's an intimacy with the writer, and you gain the maturity and the clarity of thought and the insight and the ability to see, to some degree, from that person. It depends on how you read, whether it just sort of washes over, or if you take it in more deeply. And that's without even then attempting to then write my own poetry. I found just that what I was taking in was really affecting me. And it begs the question of what happens when we're just reading on the internet. Sorry, I saw Tim first, and then
one of my professors at Gordon Conwell, Dr. T.D. Gordon, wrote this book a few years ago titled "Johnny Can't Read."
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he's studying McLarenism. I think that's the name. This gentleman who wrote this book about how changes in how information is given affects our understanding profoundly.
Mm.
And, you know, going all the way back to, Socrates, I think it was, who never wanted to have books in print.
Mm.
He thought you had to have it in the mind, right? Because once you put it in print, it's stuck there.
Mm.
And it it can't change, right? Because it's now in print.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like, the funny thing about that is we wouldn't know anything about him today if it wasn't
written down. Somebody wrote it down.
But then, you know, you see it again with the, you know, the printing press.
Yeah.
How dramatically that changed the church, right? And now know what the Bible is saying. We're able to talk about it. But then now we're getting into this stage again where these changes in how information is given is affecting how we think.
Mm.
And in this case, we're thinking less to the point where Johnny can't read very well anymore. Mm-hmm. We're not being trained to think in a very substantive way.
Yeah.
You just have to be mindful. It's, you know, these things change and they're, you know, I like technology. I like being able to Google things.
Mm-hmm.
But all the while I'm saying, you know, how much of it is true, what I'm getting out there that I can so easily accept, you know, have access to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really recommend everybody read this book called The Shallows. He makes a wonderful, sort of the larger overarching argument that he's making is that the revolution of the printing press that's democratized knowledge and literacy to the whole world is actually being undone by digital technology. And he's saying that the number of people that, you know, that changed, the number of people that read long tracts of writing and many pages or long thoughts or well-organized argument hugely increased and exploded, and the technological revolution now is shrinking that back down, and that a very select group of people actually read arguments that take longer than a tweet or a paragraph or a short news article, and sort of arguing that we're moving back to a dark age. There is this warning of a movement back towards a dark age where fewer and fewer people actually will be doing that. Nicholas Carr, it's called The Shallows. I brought a copy with me. This is one of my most lent out books at Labrie. It's got like eight people's underlining in it, but that's it. Sorry, you wanted to...
Yeah, I have a question, and others can feel free to contribute, but because of this, that science is fascinating. Is there, I was wondering if you have examples, or is there any hope of redeeming sound bites or viral videos? Or?
That's a good question. I had a student once, he worked at a Norwegian communication school. He was a graduate student. It's one of the premier communications and media schools in Norway. And he said, our youth group, it wasn't youth group, whatever the college ministry is, we're attempting to make a Christian viral video. And this is what they were trying to come up with, a video that they could get to go viral. They would have some sort of Christian message to it. And this is precisely the same question that came to my mind, is like, can this form of media be redeemed?
And by redeemed, I don't necessarily mean using it in a Christian...
Yeah.
But just...
Used well.
Yes. To the benefit of our thinking, or to the furthering of it.
Yeah, I think that's a question that has to be asked of every single new technology that comes into existence. And what I've found is that every technology proposes a gain, but it also takes away something. And I think that for the first step you have to look at is what is lost by this gain. What do we not do because we now do this? But I think that you have to ask the question is, what does this technology... I don't know, is there...
It's a message to the technology itself.
Yes, yes.
The media may not get the message.
Yeah.
And that there's a clash.
Yes, you know, yes.
Between the way that you're delivering it and what you're delivering. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the church has made some huge mistakes.
Thank you, Lynn.
Trying to adopt the medium in an unthinking way.
Yeah.
And it clashes with the message.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a part of what I've cut out of the viral video section, actually, is that viral videos rely on that sort of perverted curiosity. And that's what I said to him, is I don't think you can do it, actually, because a viral video promises some sort of ability to see something that's slightly gross or slightly extreme or that sort of plays on a perverted sense of curiosity. That's what makes it go viral. Now, using a short video is not necessarily, is a different thing. But he was trying to make it go viral, where it spreads. And the ones that spread are the baby in the pushchair that falls into the subway track and survives somehow, or the bicyclist that almost eats it, or you don't see it. I've never seen a viral video. Well,
that's,
I don't know. I've seen it. Yeah.
I understand Ms. Dye's point, but I also think that the big
call me that here.
<Where's the rabbit? laughs> I think so much that a lot of this comes down to motivation and discernment. I think that there is a place for, if you understand that something that you're doing right now, that you're tired and now is not the time to think deep thoughts, and you know that what you're looking at is a distraction, that there may be a place for some distractions. I mean, there's a lot of things that we do that are distractions. You have to understand it's a distraction. If you don't, and you're looking at it as knowledge, or you're not making one of those distinctions, then there's a danger there. I do agree that there are certain messages that where the media and the message don't fit. But I think that we have to be very careful to not... I mean, this is what our kids are doing. So how do we reach our kids in this environment? And it doesn't mean that you necessarily try to present the gospel in an intellectual way in a viral video. And there are some viral videos that are positive, that
have gone viral.
That have gone viral. Yeah. Heroics. People do, there are certain ones. There was one a while back about some, it had to do with a parent correcting a child. And it went viral because so many parents recognize that what this mother was doing was brave and courageous and the right thing to do.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not saying that you necessarily take an intellectual message, but if we're going to sit there and condemn the medium for transmitting truth that we don't agree with, then is there not some place to adapt the truth to that medium? Not necessarily, I'm not saying it's an exclusive thing or an only thing, but is there not a place for it? You know, in other words, is there a way to think about it correctly or to redeem it? Is it completely unredeemable simply because of the technology and the way it's transmitted? And I think that in a lot of ways, the church has to be careful that we're just going to be completely left behind if we say the only way that you can learn is X, and none of our kids know how to learn that way.
Well,
I'm not saying that you don't. Well, go ahead. No, what are you saying?
I mean, when you say none of our kids, you mean just
in broad general sweeping at large. I don't
sure.
mean
generation. We're painting. Right. We got big brushes tonight.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a very well put side of the question that I've wrestled with for years. Don't have a good answer for you. Sorry, my Francis and Ken.
One thing I can speak to this too, I think, but I've lectured on this here, so I won't go into too much detail. But before I moved to Free as a Worker, and I think one of the differences with the type of technology that Dan is talking about and that we're working with now that's maybe different from other types of technology. I mean, you're exactly right, right? With every development, there's sort of a pro and a con. But I think one of the things with the type of technology we're seeing now is that it is rewiring our brains. It's actually changing the way our brains function in a way that I think other developments in history have not. Mm-hmm. And this type of technology has now been around long enough, I mean, it's still relatively new, that studies have been done on children and the impact that it has on children. And none of it is positive. None of it is positive. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it's impacting really significant things. And I think all of us are sitting here talking about this. You know, I remember life without the internet very well. You know, so I had a significant, I mean, half of my life at this point was pre-internet. But we're talking about a generation that has never existed in the world without it. And what the negative impact that it's having on kids, aside from language, I mean, that's a piece of it, but even aside from language, it's impacting attention, it's impacting abstract language, higher level thought, problem solving skills, all of these things that are important players to even be able to do what you're talking about doing. The curiosity, the ability to parse things out. And so I think
Now, on the one hand, it's here to stay. It's not going anywhere. So, to your point, we have to do something with it because it's here. We can't turn a blind eye to it because it is here.
You come into the, you remember pre-internet.
Yes.
Do you remember pre-TV?
I do.
Television.
I'm probably the oldest one.
Because when television first came out, they did studies that said that kids were just going to become mind-numbed robots, and it was nothing but negative. And I'm not saying that there has not been significant negative impact from television, clearly.
I'll speak to that one.
But what I was going
to
say is that
from age 7 to 18, I OD on TV. Mm-hmm. From 18 to now, I've never owned a TV.
But see, that's the thing, is that in spite of the fact that people said when that technology came up that the next generation, which would be myself and a lot of us, we're going to be mind-numbed robots and have no ability to think, we're sitting here tonight having a discussion about the next wave of technology. I'm not saying it doesn't have a negative impact, but we have to be careful not to overstate it, and how do we work in spite of it, or with it, or whatever. It's, I think, just part of a bigger discussion.
Absolutely. I think one of the differences, though, is this is with us all the time. It's in our pocket all the time. I mean, I think, television, it used to be, it permanently lived in one place, and if you weren't physically in that place, you weren't exposed to it. We're now at the point where,
you can watch it on your phone.
You can watch it on your phone. I mean, we have kids who, most of their waking hours, they're plugged in, and so I do think there is a difference, and I hear your point that it's not all doom. I mean, there's amazing things that have come out of it. I mean, amazing things. But I think that's just a bigger, I think that the just high percentage of time that kids are now spending in front of screens that what it's doing as far as the moving, the switching, is changing our brain chemistry to such a way that some of the things that you're talking about, Danny, are actually becoming harder for kids to do.
Yeah. Ken, you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm one of the, obviously, of the generation that was, TV was nascent when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that the internet changed at least my work life in so many positive ways I can't even tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of it really is a revolution. The internet, just in the technical content of the internet, and to be able to call up things to help your any kind of technical work that you're doing or relaying information. I when I was a younger engineer, I was a draftsman, and I actually drew on a drafting table. Anybody know what a drafting table is?
Mm-hmm.
So I actually drew on a drafting table, and I used to think to myself, boy, wouldn't it be great if I could somehow transmit my ideas to the supplier who's actually going to make this thing and have him put it on the tool right away? And I mean, I was thinking these things 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and now it is instantaneous. You don't have to have a human involved. You can model the whole thing together. I mean, obviously the human has to create it, but once you've done that, you take that and you download it to another server, who then downloads it to a machine, that will make the product, model the product. I mean, everything is just kind of right at your fingertips.
Mm.
So that really is, to me, is the positive part. Mm-hmm. The negative part kind of goes back to what the gentleman over here was talking about when I'm sure he didn't mean it this way, but we sort of start thinking, he made the comment that we may have a truth we don't agree with. Well, there is no truth we don't agree with. There's only truth. And the internet gives us a whole shopping cart worth of truths, but there is only one truth. We may not agree that it is the truth, but it's still there's still only one truth.
Mm-hmm.
And now we used to have 8 or 10 of these out there that we were confronted with, on a yearly or a lifetime basis. Now we have thousands of different quote truths But there really is only one truth. You can't disagree with truth. You can disagree that it is truth,
mm-hmm.
but you can't disagree with truth. Truth is truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ken. Yep. Sorry, what's your name?
Anna.
Anna, thank you.
Couple of questions on the obstacles. I just want to make a couple, like, push back flatly. And
oh, good.
I had a, other question for you, too. Kind of going off of what was said over here earlier, the idea of distraction, and also you mentioned, like, reliance on cliches. I think that those are, they really are, can be double-edged, because I know sometimes part of what's helped you think clearly about a situation that I'm struggling with or thinking through is distracting myself for a while. And sometimes literally, especially with like really difficult times in my life where my mind and my body and my emotions were taxed so much, it was only through distraction sometimes that I kind of maintained some sanity, to be honest. Like, so I think that sometimes it's an obstacle and sometimes it's actually a stepping stone to the actually clear thinking. And
hang on, can we talk about that before, and you'll get another go?
Sure.
Yeah, I really like that. It helps to distinguish maybe for us, make a distinction between the kind of distraction I'm talking about and you were talking about it being a necessary part of reality. Maybe you think of it as rest or play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're devoting your mind towards a work, you need to rest and play and you know, just divert from it for a while in order to your subconscious to work on it and that kind of stuff. Yeah, so that's really helpful. Thank you, because there is a positive place in our life for it. I was studying math in school in university, and I just got pounded on a problem for 2 hours and just kept getting it wrong and wrong. I went outside and split wood for 20 minutes really angrily and came in and was just like, done. and then absolutely. I mean, we were made to work and to play and to rest. And I mean, you look at the God giving the Sabbath to his people is similar to that. You devote your energy to something exclusively, you'll become so bound up in it that you won't be good at it. And you need to divert, you need to rest, you need to play.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah. That as well, because I think in my mind, distraction was, because I was focusing so much on the negative, that's what it was, but honestly, it was actively doing a play or rest.
Uh-huh. And one more thing on that is, I think in the internet, distraction is the norm rather than the diversion from the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is probably where I'm more concerned with it.
Could you just repeat that one more time?
The internet would like distraction to be the norm.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to the diversion from the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the second thing you wanted to say about cliches?
Oh, I don't know if you want to mention that. On cliches, I feel like sometimes they're very unhealthy and unhelpful, but sometimes cliches are there because they really do sum up something that we kind of all agree to be a valuable truth. And so sometimes I've seen people, like, again, like going through really hard times, they'll use these cliches to help them like survive the day, and it seems to be something really genuine, something really life-giving.
Mm-hmm.
So
like a mantra or a litany?
Many times for me, the day on cliches has been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God's still this afternoon, like that one.
Mm. Is that a cliche?
I've heard it a lot recently. I don't know.
Really?
The main thing I was going to ask you about, though, was what about the things that you mentioned here? You're kind of helping us focus on ourselves and what we can do to think more clearly and relate, you know, to the truth. What about when we encounter people who maybe we want to enter discussion about a certain topic, and we get that wall of, I'll give you a couple of examples of, some women I've recently met, that we have certain things in common, but we have very different worldviews. They'll put on Facebook, you know, ideas about sexuality or feminism or gender roles, all sorts of different things that they're very passionate about. And they'll say something like, So-and-so that thinks this, F you. So-and-so that thinks this, F you. And they're like, you know, look at the times in their Facebook feed, and the last one was like all capital. And I'm thinking to myself, like, if I wanted to enter into a conversation with you about this subject, you know, probably not on Facebook, but in person or something, I don't know where I would go with that, because you just now said that if you disagree with me, you're trying to, like, and so sometimes when I'm having a meaningful conversation with someone, like that, you know, I might challenge their view of like religion or God, and then I wait for their response, and they say something like, "Well, that's just my opinion," and so I'm like, "Oh, I don't know, like how to because you're just saying that's your opinion, so that in a discussion,
the end of
the
discussion."
Yeah. So anyway, I just wondered if you had any thoughts on how to engage, you know, through this. We are in an age of soundbites and viral videos. If you have any ideas about how to engage with who maybe haven't heard a lecture like this and haven't had a chance to practice.
Finding the right gentle question is the answer that I would give, and the very difficult thing to do. But finding the right gentle question is the hardest thing to do. You can find lots of questions that will inflame things or shut things down. But you know, at its best, a question is an invitation to walk together on a topic. Let's walk together for a little while on this. Would you be willing to walk with me a little bit farther on this? Is basically what the right question is inviting. The wrong question is an attack, is an attempt to subvert, is an aggressive act. And I think with some people that's actually very helpful and the right thing to do. But in the environment that you described that I think so many people live in, people do not know how to deal with difference anymore. And that's my opinion, is one of those cliche shutdowns. Like that has the sort of culturally agreed upon meaning of this conversation is not going past this.
I think this gets back and to what you're talking about with curiosity. Because the question is the thing that you're talking about, the gentle question, is something that invites them to become curious beyond where they've shut it off with the cliche. In other words, the cliche shows, I've thought about it to this extent and I'm done. And if you come up with a question, it's funny, maybe it's a personality thing. There are times at work that I've found that, you know, you don't have a time, an opportunity to actually engage people. So this might be the wrong way to think of it, but I'll look at things in terms of throwing a hand grenade. In other words, and this, which is the exact opposite of a gentle question, I think there's a place for both. But there are times when all you can do is throw something out there that challenges somebody's belief and makes them a little more curious so that they think about it more. And sometimes that's all you have the time to do. Sometimes that's a gentle question, depending on the circumstance. And other times that can be a little bit more aggressive to make them, to jar them out of their thinking. But the curiosity, I think, is the key to both of those things. That the cliche says, I've thought to this point, and I'm all done. And if you can get them to think beyond that, then that's
to take a step farther, yeah. It is such a difficult thing to do, to know the right. It is such a difficult thing to do. And in our day and age where we're so bad at dealing with difference, it requires so much relational groundwork, I would say. In this day and age, you have to do a ton of relational groundwork before you can challenge somebody on something. If you meet a serious Muslim, don't worry about it. You can chuck a hard question right back and expect 10 back at you. In many Muslim cultures, that's a sign of intimacy and love, is to like, that's complete rubbish. I cannot believe you believe that. What about this? What about this? What about this? They'll be like, yeah, what about this? What about this? And that's love, you know, in our culture. that's not a good sign of love for many people. It's a very difficult environment we live in. But try and be persistent and try again if you get it wrong. Find the right question. So in the back, and then
another interesting point that you mentioned, the Muslim culture would engage in this, and in our culture we've moved towards this moral relativism. So now we don't value
not just truth. Moral, everything relative.
Right. We don't value truth. We don't believe that in absolute truth. And so even aside from technology, if it all disappeared, how many people would engage in really trying to understand an idea if the conclusion of that idea had no value?
Yeah.
And which, you know, how much does that societal viewpoint affect us as compared to technology and medium?
Yeah. That reminds me of one thing, that with the way that technology works, there's a ghettoization of ideas or I don't know what the right word is, but grouping. Compartmentalization, but people group up by what they agree with much better. And I think if you've got someone in a room, it's very different than if you're on Facebook, because that shutdown is, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I'm going to defriend you if you believe anything else. And that the internet seems to push people into enclaves of belief with very strong boundaries, and they actually do not interact as much as in this gray, grand, mixing, pluralistic culture that everybody talks about. We're not that. We don't mix, and we're dividing more geographically. They say we're dividing more and more ideologically. So if you can get into physical presence with people, that is worth a billion. If you're sitting at a lunch table, if you're sitting at a dinner table with them, you've gone miles towards taking a step further. The workplace, I think, is usually where people encounter this, and I find the workplace is a very difficult one for that. Sort of people assume they'll come in contact with different people, but like, we'll just leave it right here. That's a tough one to get across. I got one guy at work. He is amazing how fast and hard he shuts down the second you go to any idea. It's not even like religious ones. It's just like, you know, like, you'll never believe what Donald Trump just said. Bam! Shut down. Because we go into some realm of idea. It's really interesting. Yeah. Sorry, you had that.
I think I see those as two different things. I see the internet and where we are today as the fulfillment of what we have been striving for 50 years or maybe more. But this is, like, we have been told for the last 50 years that science and technology and all of that is the most wonderful thing in the entire world, and we're now reaching the fulfillment of where we've been striving as a society to go. I mean, the internet is a very amazing accomplishment for all of us, for humanity. You know, we have all the information we could possibly want. You know, at a click of a button, I can watch any show I want. I can do whatever I want. It's amazing what we have done in the past 50 to 100 years. But what I find very interesting is the cost that that comes at. Because I think as a society, we don't think there's a cost attached to it. We're just go, 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 go. Here's the end. We have to reach this goal at all costs. Let's go. There's nothing bad about it. There's no negative things. And I think that's what most people in our society think, that in the end, all of our technology, all of our advancements, all of our go human, you know, has reached us to the end, and it's all good, because the people who lived a long time ago, they didn't have these things. They were just the dummies, you know, and we're the really smart people, and we've finally gotten there. And I can remember being in, I was a programmer at the beginning of the tech revolution, like with the internet and everything else, so I, you know, have a technical background, and I can remember being in school thinking that, what kind of idiot would go to school for, like, history or English, where you can only become a teacher, and who would be dumb enough to do that? You're not going to make any money. But now I kind of see that it's two totally different things. Once we strive as a society for all of our technological advancements, we've completely lost the human side of our life. And if that is our goal, and I keep asking the question, what is the goal? What is the end goal? Where is this insane trek that we're all on? Where are we going, and where is the end of it? And I agree. I agree that it is bad for humanity overall. Like, I know that there's wonderful things about the internet. I mean, like I said, I was the programmer making those wonderful things. But at the end of it all, I would gladly take our humanity back as a society. I would sit around and read Edith Nesbitt's books, you know, and, you know, go back to a more simple age where we read words and we had languages and we had ideas. I think not having the ideas and not even being able to engage about ideas. I don't care that I can talk about the latest YouTube video, you know, because it's not adding to us as humans, and it is detracting, and I don't think it's neutral, and I don't think you can do a, you know, I think when we rise here, we sink really low here. We don't just stay here and rise. We have to. It's like a seesaw.
Yeah.
I think part of the drive for technology is because it's our savior.
It is.
People have to believe that things are going to get better and put their hope in something. If they don't put it in God, they have to put it in science and technology. And so you can't really question it. You have to just pursue it headlong, because without that, you don't have anything. If you don't have, you know, if there's no spiritual aspect.
Yeah, it is really the evolutionary narrative. And you know, regardless of evolution as a science question, that has become our overarching narrative, that we are progressing towards greater something
well,
greater, transhumanness.
Greater, download ourselves yeah. and live forever.
That's the ultimate idea.
It's not greater.
Yeah, I'm curious about how, because if you look around online in news, sort of more reflective news magazines, you hear these rumblings and these questions being asked, but I don't know quite how. They don't seem to be doing anything. Study after study comes out. Study after study comes out. This stuff's bad for you. There's things like the cognitive psychologists are all over this stuff. They love it because I don't know why they love it so much, but they're coming up with study after study. You know, you watch an hour of television. Does it lights up all the same parts of your brain as heroin? And
yeah.
and in children, the withdrawal from television is similar to a chemical addiction, biochemically in your brain. And I've seen it in my kids. They go completely insane after when we turn off the television. And it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. But I'm curious about the, because sort of fundamental to what we're talking about is a lack of a reflective public discourse. That's what the problem we're saying is. And so you can't have a reflective public discourse if the problem is that you're not having reflective public discourse.
Right.
There's no public discourse to be had about this
right.
missing public discourse. And I think a part of what Nicholas Carr gets at in his book is he does go back to the Augustinian monastery movement as being an essential preserver of knowledge and culture. And some other thinkers have gone after this, that what is needed at times when cultures go crazy is you need enclaves and communities that will preserve what is good and will commit themselves to the preservation of knowledge. And he says that what we're going back to is that sort of time where there will be enclaves of people that read and think. Now, I think that Christians need to be among those people. Sorry? The Benedictine option. Thank you. Sorry. The
Benedict
option. Yeah. I am not a, yeah, changing culture like the sort of the 2000s and 90s and the Christians were going to preserve the culture and change the culture and redeem the culture had a pretty bad legacy. And so I'm a bit skeptical about the sort of big plan. We're going to kill the internet, all the bad effects of the internet. You know, Christians are going to do that. No, they're not going to do that. The Lord possibly will do that. He may not as well. But our responsibility as individuals is to the way that we function in the world. And want to change the culture? Try to stop yourself. Try to stop yourself from clicking on the clickbait. I struggle with it myself. Yeah. Yes, new hand in the back. Thank you.
I have a question. Hasn't completely
opened
my head yet.
Great.
To criticize technology,
yes.
But like, why are people using technology? Because they don't have physical friends around them very much. Are they using it just to chase clickbait, or are they using it to communicate with friends? That's the only way of having a friend. Most of the time is like, we live in such a moving society that we can't like sit down and have a conversation. Mm. So I have to text you if I want a conversation. And, like, are viral videos just these terrible things floating around, or are they the same thing as, like, me telling you a joke and let's laugh? Or, like, it's different, like, there's a lot of negative stuff about it, but at the same time, there's a lot of positive. You cut that out, and people don't have any friends. They don't have any way of
That takes us back to Pascal, doesn't it?
Yeah. Let's go back and look at Pascal's quote on that one. Where are we? Catch up. Yeah, this is quote.
I hear what you're saying, and there's a sense that we shouldn't abandon people that are isolated in the internet shouldn't be abandoned there. I had one fellow at my lunch discussion say he was really into multi-player something games, like World of Warcraft. And he's like, this is the only place that these people are. This is the only place that these people interact. So I'm going there to interact with them and be with them because that's the only place that they are. And I resonate with that. And there's a sense that people shouldn't be abandoned in that world. It's okay, it happens all the time. But to your comment that I guess I sense in your comment sort of a resignation that that's the only place that they could be, and if we took that away from them, wouldn't they just be alone? Well, yes, they would be alone, but this is what Pascal's pointing us at, is that without this distraction, we should be in a state of weariness, and this weariness might spur us towards something greater. And I lived for about 6 months without any internet in my house. Just I was poor, and it happened that way. And I picked up a violin that I hadn't played since I was 13, and I started playing again. And it was a very, very rich period of my life, and I actually would love to go back to it in some sense, because that empty space had pushed me to find something more substantial. And I think that's what it takes courage, but I think we should be courageous to step out from that. There are people that say, well, if I'm not on Facebook, how am I going to know when this or that thing happens? But in answer to that question, I've heard another student say, well, like, yeah, I got off Facebook, and then they realized it wasn't at the first party, and then after that they called me. Like, oh, relationships still happen. People actually can reach out to one another. I think it's this sense that we cannot live without it. I think that's a really dangerous one, and that it, like, we have no choice. I think that, for me, that's quite dangerous. Nikayla?
And I think the danger, which you don't hear about, is that your brain starts shrinking and your capacity for curiosity and attentiveness and those virtues, you start losing the ability to develop those. Mm. It's not just as if you have them and they grow. You have them and they shrink.
Mm.
And, you know, all the information the information processing and executive function and the parts of your brain that start shrinking the more distracted we become. Like, that's also where, you know, empathy, character development, curiosity and attentiveness and your ability to hold a thought and to really know it. Like, that, those parts of our brain are not growing, they're shrinking.
Mm.
I think that is part of the conversation that's also just not being looked at enough.
Mm.
Is, you know, what are some of the things we can be doing, being curious,
yeah,
and being patient. But if our brains are losing the capacity for that, you know, that just becomes harder and harder and harder to sort of grow that. And that's what is so fearful about children in their capacity for patience and curiosity and attentiveness, is that when it should be expanding and developing, it's not. It's being stunted. So I think that is a huge danger for young children. And all the information now about your brain being able to regenerate itself and all of these things, that is all also around empathy and our ability to be empathetic. And I just think this is a really important part of the conversation, is that it's just not neutral. Your brain is changing.
It's not this or that option for relationship or for life. Yeah, when I don't recommend that people just stop using it. And I don't want you to hear that I'm thinking that. I'm trying to say that because I recognize that's probably not an option right now. But what I would encourage you to do is to sit back, take a step back and take stock of what is lost if I just naturally go into this and use this and participate in reality in this way. What is lost? And do I have to lose it? And I think that's the thing, is that it doesn't have to be lost. So when email comes around, people stop writing hard letters. You could still write a letter. But the thing is that the heart, that the thing that's lost, it's not that it's taken away from you, it's that it becomes harder to do because the easier thing showed up. Like Ken was talking about, all this information's right at my fingertips. But what is lost is what this gentleman was saying about the value of going and searching through a library and finding valuable pieces of information and seeing them as valuable. So now, just because everything's lost doesn't mean you couldn't go to a library. Doesn't mean you couldn't just relish in, you know, the substantiveness of knowledge. Or because you write a lot of emails, doesn't mean you cannot sit and actually write a letter. And in some senses, the cheapening of communication has made more valuable handwritten letters. So what you need to do is ask yourself, what's been lost, and can I practice it now? What used to be ubiquitous and normal, can that now become a discipline? And I would say that's what we need to do. So if reading the news, in just scanning headlines and clicking on the occasional one, go buy a newspaper once a month and read it front to back. And I do that occasionally, and it's a wonderful experience because I actually read whole articles that I would never click on. never click on articles. But if I'm sitting at the coffee shop for an hour while the kids are doing something, I just will page to page, including the obituaries, including the classifieds, just see what's there. I get lately I've been getting this local newspaper that's way local and way low tech, and people are selling, like, you know, a stack of I don't know what for $25 and in the back of it. And it's fascinating to me, and I've started reading it cover to cover. I can't wait till it comes. And I think that, yes, Action Unlimited. That's it. I love it. Free advertising in there. And you see what, like, the Sudbury Women's Group is doing, and you see what these people are doing, and something about it is so substantive, actually, where to me, in an age where so much is easily clicked. It's a discipline.
Part of it, you know.
Yeah.
It's the discernment in knowing where your limits are.
And what, what you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sue, thank you.
This is probably covering a bit of ground you all know anyway, but most of us here who have spoken tonight have actually lived part or most of our lives without internet being there all the time.
And we couldn't get your kids in here.
Most of us have had more exposure to different types of language and the deepening of language more so than most children growing up these days. And that's the scary thing. Is the children who were born with a cell phone in their hand and who at 9 months can do that. You know, and
mind-blowing.
I learned that a couple of years ago. And, you know, 9 months old babies can do it. Everybody says, how long do they can do it? But these are the children who grow up not being exposed to even be able to talk, to have this discussion, because they don't know an alternative, and a lot of them will not have the language or the way of critique.